Zalzi, congratulations on your anniversary. 13 years on the 22nd, a big significant number for you. You took Taryn out to Robertson. You guys had a ball. I saw the palace you stayed in. I just want to know, brother, did you manage to watch any rugby this
week? Mate, I watched it all. I actually did get some rugby in. Yeah, great time, great part of the world, beautiful part of the world. And then, when you are in relaxed mode, there seems to be much more time. So got to get my eyes on Lion Sharks, bit of Six Nations. And we kept the bride going. It was great. We had a great time.
Congratulations, mate. I just want to know the big one for the weekend. Obviously, you watched that Switzerland against the Netherlands.
That was a very important game, that.
It was an important game. Yeah. You know why it was?
Obviously, everybody knows why, but you tell the...
History making.
There you go.
First time ever that Switzerland in Rugby Europe have beaten the Netherlands. 29-23, 76th minute. It was a great finish. And as you can see, I had a lot of time this weekend, okay? But what was
relevant, where did you even see that?
What's relevant about that one is that 6 months ago, or 8 months ago, the Netherlands beat Switzerland 73-0 in Rugby Europe, which is, for those who don't know it, from South Africa, that is like the B division of the Six Nations. So it's eight teams, two pools. Portugal, obviously on fire, and they are going to the World Cup.
Here you go.
They topped the pool, 3-3. Georgia topped the pool, 3-3. Spain was second. They beat them 42-30 in the big thriller on the weekend. A lot of South Africans club players play for those teams. If you are one of them, contact us. Drop a little comment in. Mail me kio@kio.co.za, and we want to talk a bit about what you guys are doing. It's our commitment and contribution to the poor of the game. And to getting the messaging out there.
If you're still watching this episode, congratulations. You really do love your rugby.
All right. Now, onto the big stuff.
Where did they play that game? I need to know. Where did they play?
They played that game in Switzerland.
Switzerland.
And the home team. Yeah, they played the game there. So that was a great, great result.
Because
all the
fields in Holland were clogged.
They weren't clogged, but this is all kind of, they played on wonderful surfaces. There's some great facilities there, and the game is growing and continues to grow. Mm. The Netherlands, surprising with that result, they won from three, so they out of the mix. But Georgia went through, Spain second, and then Portugal, obviously. So you're looking at Spain, not quite there, even though they're going to the World Cup, and you're looking at Georgia, Portugal, and they were bloody good at the last World Cup. So if you are still with us now, I know you love the show.
Best thing about playing for Switzerland, mate, halftime, hot chocolate, Swissmas, Conmas.
And Roger Federer. Now.
Yes.
Six Nations, URC, where do you want to start, bud?
We'll go with, let's save the big stuff for later. Let's do the Six Nations first.
All right. Let's start with Louis Bielby, my favorite player. 24th try in his 25th test. He was on fire. The Napoleon, the little magician, the warrior, Antoine Dupont, he was very, very good.
Yeah.
19-8 to Italy with 10 minutes to go. Two quick fire tries, 33-8. People say it's a distortion. The game is played over 80 minutes. But there has been massive improvement from this Italian side, which again showcases how well we did to beat them 45-0 in South Africa and how well we did to beat them quite comfortably playing with 14 people in very difficult conditions in the November series. What the Six Nations keeps on telling me is just how bloody good we were on tour last November.
No, but we knew that already. We knew that already.
I know, but it's nice to get it
nice
played
to talk
out
about it again. Exactly. Yeah, look, the box obviously on another level. I think France were full value for the win, but I think that scoreline definitely does flatter France. I felt like in that game, destiny was against Italy. Every single loose bounce, every single 50-50 seemed to go France's way. Even when Italy tried to create opportunities and they put the ball through, the bounce just didn't favour them, the ball didn't come to them. It was just going to be one of those days from the beginning. Italy, I think, are definitely a team on the up. An ascending team, and I think France showed their value and their power as the top team in Europe.
It does look like it's France at the moment, and then the rest.
Definitely.
Jalibert at 10, he was a late withdrawal. Ramos went to 10. Right winger went to fullback. A new winger, debut from Toulon on the right wing. He scored late in the game, apparently the quickest in France. They are producing midfielders and winners like we produce loose forwards.
That is the truth. But I think the thing there, and we spoke about it, is that when your pack dominates, when you have momentum on tap, all of the backs look at least 20% better, and the reverse is true. When the pack's struggling, people go, oh, I don't know, can that guy really handle the test arena at centre? I think the French backs are very good, and I think what they've done very well there is they've created depth. They're not reliant on one guy. Damien Pinot is not even in the mix. We've seen new guys come in and pick up where they left off. So they are very, very dangerous. But I think most of the credit should go to that pack of forwards. In Europe, they dominate.
Is this a case of, you know, in New Zealand, it used to be the Joe Rokotokos, the Julian Saviors. They make their debuts at 19 or 20. They retire them at 25. They scored 40-odd tries. Then they go to Europe. They play another 6-7 years and are great performers, club rugby, either in Europe or in Japan. Damien Pinot, a few months ago, was considered the best right winger in the world, up there with a Kurt Lee Aronson, for example,
yeah,
or a Cheslin Kolbe in terms of winners, given that Aronson Kolbe can play both, left or right. And obviously has had a fallout with Fabien Galthi, who said to him, back you go to your club, Bordeaux, where he has been in good form for Bordeaux in the top 14 in the Investec Champions Cup, and said, go work on your defense. Now, he's the top try scorer for France. He's played in a couple of World Cups. They didn't seem to have a problem with his defense back then. But what's happened is he's picked kids in his place, and they've just blossomed.
And that's why Fabien deserves a lot of credit, because when he picked the second-rate side to go to New Zealand, there was lots of fanfare around that. How can you do this? It's taking something away from these tours and yada, yada, yada. But he's created depth through exactly those kind of programs, and it's win-win, because now Damien's back at Bordeaux, itching, champing at the bit to get back into the French setup. So if he does end up back in the mix, he's going to be frothing to produce his best rugby. And the guy who's replaced him right now, it sends a message to the rest of the tiers in French rugby that, hey, our eyes are open. We don't have our favorites. You know, the door's open to anybody to come in here who can produce, and you will get your opportunity. So for French rugby, it's win, win, win.
And if you know French players and you know the French, I don't think he's frothing. It's c'est la vie. He's having a good time.
You think so?
And what will be, will be.
Maybe.
I don't think these guys go back and froth at the mouth to get back in. They eventually just get back in and then play.
Mm.
They seem to have this wonderful philosophy and view on life. What will be, will be. That's why they have
la vie. Wow. Yeah.
So, I watched the highlights. I kind of didn't watch the game live. France against Italy.
I thought you were a serious rugby person.
Yeah, I'd watched Switzerland. I mean, what Switzerland beating the Netherlands? I mean, yeah. Where else can you go? Oh, you can go down to Christchurch and see the Brumbies win by 50 points to 24.
What's happening there? They're back in the hole in Canterbury.
Yeah, and they couldn't blame Jacques Nienaber for that one either. Yeah. But we'll get to Ireland a little bit later. But looking at France, 3 from 3, they're topping the table, 15 points. I don't see anyone stopping them. Scotland believe they got a chance. They've always historically given them a tough game. And then the decider, if it does come down to that, is the roast beefs, England in Paris. We all thought that could be the big game. At the moment, that's the game England doesn't want to play. And I also heard England don't really want to play us anymore on the 4th of July, and they don't want to play us next week. They've got a week off, but they don't want to play us. How did those guys go from the hype of being heroes to the wannabe humbled mob that we saw battered and beaten up by Scotland in the first 20 minutes and battered and beaten up by Ireland? They conceded 17 points in the first 20 minutes against Scotland at Murrayfield and 22-0 down against Ireland. And that 22, there were a couple of missed kicks in. It could have been closer to 30 on 30 minutes. What did you make of that? Because I had England to win 30-21. I had them to win quite comfortably. I thought their pack would destroy them. The pack looked non-existent. Luke Cowan-Dickey looked like he had met Maro Itoje in the tunnel and thought he was 4'4" instead of 6'8". I couldn't find him. George Ford looked like he was playing in Manchester, not in southwest London. They were just a shambles. And Ireland pitched up, forgot about Jacques Nienaber and Leinster, and played like the Ireland of old.
Well, mate, if you read around now, Ireland are back, baby. They are the hot stuff again this week, which is quite funny. For me, I mean, this is from a guy who picked England to win the Six Nations before that kicked off. That was a very, very disappointing performance. And this weekend kind of showed why you can never really take Scotland or England seriously, it seems. because neither of those guys learned from last week. So Scotland almost lost to Wales. A week after they won the Calcutta Cup, beat England by kicking them, they went straight back to what Scotland wants to do, which is just attack, play ball from everywhere, and almost lost the game against a very, very, very poor Wales team. So kudos to them for rescuing it with a try that they probably will never score again from a kickoff. But I thought Scotland showed absolutely no experience or growth from what they'd done in that Calcutta Cup game against England. Then England, having lost to Scotland, being outkicked against Scotland, they went into the Irish game and kicked even less. And the Irish dominated the kicking game, dominated the key facets, and beat England quite convincingly. So disappointing for England. The team that they've picked and the way that they need to play for that team to fire, we spoke about it last week, is don't surrender early leads. You need to come out hot, build scoreboard pressure, make the other team chase, then the whole thing works. But this England team is, they're not playing that kind of a game at all. And for the second week in a row, they got caught on a cold start.
Did it surprise you that there was no real dominance from the England pack over Ireland? Ireland technically kind of managed the scrum set piece and then dominated I've never seen an England lineout look such a shambles from the first throw.
Totally.
But also this kind of cocky confidence of we just have to pitch up to win this game. Very similar to what they produced at Murrayfield and then found themselves three scores down and just weren't good enough to come back from that.
No, totally.
And what you can see is that they can't chase a game. Question the selections again. I love going online straight after an England defeat and seeing Will Greenwood do the walk, especially.
Yeah, that was fun.
Especially the car park walk.
Yeah.
Because he just looks like he's been battered, especially if they take a beating.
Yeah.
And I mean, he said, props to Ireland, you were amazing. And then he just went into England, okay? Made nine changes to the starting 15.
Yeah.
All on emotion.
Yeah.
James Haskell did the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's, again, we do get carried away with, and like the Stormers went 8 from 8, but you don't always dissect the 8 from 8. You know, these guys are just unbeatable now. They've got to take the URC. England, 12 wins in a row. And then you think, hang on a second, they beat an understrength Argentinian side and could have lost that second test and went down to the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
Won the games they should have won in the Six Nations. Beat a woefully poor Australian side. And were always going to beat that New Zealand side because they had a pack to dominate New Zealand. And I think their psyche, the moment they beat New Zealand, was like, we can win the World Cup and bring on the Springboks. The game has changed in the last 18 months to 24 months in terms of who's who in the zoo. And at the moment, it is South Africa and France.
Mm-hmm.
They do set the tone. Ireland were there and thereabouts. They've got problems. And then England, the great white hopes again. The great white dopes. And so kind of we all bought the hype. I bought the hype. I thought, actually, this England side could be worth something.
I think they can be. But I think the team is just too cerebral. It's too, there's too much talking. There's too much, these are the plans. England needs to come out with Georgie Ford at 10 and Alex Mitchell or Van Poortvliet at 9. England needs to come out and play a very tactical game that is underwritten by brute force and physicality in the collisions and in the set piece. And they didn't deliver on that. It's kind of like they're throwing the ball to Georgie Ford to do something amazing. Everybody's already thinking about how they're going to score tries and how they're going to beat guys in space. But they haven't done the basics yet. And I think England needs to get back to that and maybe do a little bit less thinking and a little bit leave the thinking to Georgie Ford. The rest of the team, just pound the next guy in front of you. Just take somebody on, physically mash them, and let Georgie handle what happens after that.
Well, George Ford went from play of the match against Wales in the opener to this is why Owen Farrell is not considered to why the hell is he there? It's been incredible to watch. They talk about the New Zealand media and the South African media, and we are classified, obviously, as global media.
Mm.
So not necessarily just South African. But post an Irish-England game, I always love going to watch and read because I don't know who's more brutal, the Irish media when they lose or the English media when they lose. But I think it's marginally. It is the English media. And who's more sycophantic? Definitely the Irish media. Because Ireland were reborn. Jock Nienaber wasn't mentioned. He wasn't thanked. Ireland were back. They found their DNA. They found their identity again. What they found was some rugby intelligence again. They found a 10 that's a little bit more grounded. And they found an opponent who felt they just had to arrive to win.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think You know, as much as they will look at the changes in the team and the success of the team on the weekend, the star of the show was Stuart McCloskey, a guy we've spoken about before from Ulster. A nice big unit. I think when we originally spoke about him, we were like, wow, this is a nice new kid on the Irish scene. This was a couple of years back. And they were like, oh, wow, he's already 27 years old. Like, it's fantastic that McCloskey reeled in Marcus Smith and had a barnstorming run. But he's in the twilight of his career now, probably. You know, he's in his 30s. I think early 30s. So, it's just too late. It's just too late for some of these guys. I love Bobby Balakoon, as you know, a big fan of his. And I love Jamie Osborne. And I think O'Brien is a good player. Frawley's a guy we've spoken about. I think there's value there. But all of those guys I just mentioned are in the back line. And as much as Caelan Doris got huge props for what he did on the weekend, I'm still not convinced that that guy is a guy who can go toe-to-toe, pound for pound, when the heat is on against a team that brings it physical and direct. And I think that's where Ireland are going to struggle going forward. Fantastic result for them. They should pat themselves on the back. Signs of life from Ireland, but I definitely don't think Ireland are back.
Yeah, again, you'll only know that in the Nations Cup. It is called the Nations Cup, right?
I think so.
Where we play three at home.
Nations Championship.
Or Nations Championship. For those who don't know, those July internationals now have meaning. The three here in the Southern Hemisphere when the North tours, and then the three back in November, and then there's a finals weekend where six plays six, five plays five, down to one plays one, North versus South. So you guarantee the North versus South kind of winner, and invariably it should be the Six Nations champions against the Rugby Championship champions. So you're looking at potentially a France against South Africa at Twickenham. That would be great. That would be like a World Cup that we didn't get in 2015 when Australia and New Zealand played in the final.
It is the Nations Championship, and McCloskey's 33.
Is he 33? I thought he was 31. What does that say about Marcus Smith's pace?
Mate, it says he's gassed. He was exhausted.
Look, I thought, what a loose forward getting in there, but then it was the centre.
He runs like Jacques Free. He's got those wide strides, arms pumping.
Look, he's been good for Ulster for a long, long time, but he's played in Bundiaki's shadow for the best part of a decade.
And that is a big shadow.
And I thought Bundiaki was now playing in the props, because the guy who runs to the front of the line-out to give the commands is like a dead ringer for Bundiaki with a beard.
It could be, mate.
I thought, Bundy, you've extended your career by another 5 years, eh? He's moving. He's in the front row now.
Just took the one off his back.
Exactly. So, but McCloskey was really good. And again, it shows you the most underrated 12 in world rugby and the most consistent and best, Damien Delandy. He's been there. He's won two World Cups, a couple of rugby championships, was outstanding for Munster, went to Japan, has been a superstar there, and obviously we know what he did with the Stormers. But he never gets spoken about when it comes to best 12s in the world. Or really, they were claiming McCloskey's the best 12 in the world. because he ran over a non-existent England defence for much of the match.
Totally. But I think, you know, that's the difference between the media, the public, and the players. I think in the players' circles, guys like Dukes get spoken about a lot. I think it's because they do the dirty work, they're at the bottom. Franco Mostert was the same. When he was at the Lions, people were like, what does this guy actually do? It was only when he got to the box and people started to get an inkling of the work rate of that guy that they started to appreciate him. But I think in the playing ranks and the coaching ranks, those people see it quickly.
Well, if you talk about player on player, I mean, Sonny Boy Williams last season came out and said the most undervalued, underrated part of the South African puzzle is Damon Delandy. He's the glue at 12. When he's there, they're a different team than when he's not there. So, and he's got another World Cup in him. I mean, he's so... A decision to go to Japan and play there has kind of prolonged his career. Mm. And would love to see him come back and play one season at the Stormers and add some value and be like a mentorship role. But, yeah, looking at all the 12s on display and the young, great kids that are coming through with the French, what's going on in Super Rugby... Just look back and say, I pick that guy from Mulness and High. I pick him every day of the week. Damon Delandy is just such a good rugby player. Great passing game, undeniable strength in contact. And I think his rugby IQ by the general public, so underrated. Like you say, not by coaches and not by fellow players or opposition. But you know the family, you know them well. Best 12 in the world.
I mean, in his prime, absolutely, for me, Dukes is the best. And look, Kanyo Amfit's in the same conversation at 13. In their prime, absolutely sensational combination and the world's leading players in those positions. Both of those guys, obviously, in a bunch of other box, also fighting father time at this point in their careers, but still add massive, massive value. But I think the key conversation is we're still talking about these guys because there isn't a youngster that's burst through and has grabbed our attention. You know, these old dogs are still leading the charge. And rugby in each of the various countries is desperate for those young guys to come through and start making a challenge because that's the future. I mean, the guy who's pushing Dugues is Andre Esthazen. He's no spring chicken either. So, yeah, we need that next generation of youngsters to start coming through, the guys that are of the Sasha generation, I suppose, to get everybody excited about what's next.
Okay, we're three weeks into 3 out of 5 rounds into Six Nations. They take a break for a week. France, 15 points. They've still got to play Scotland and England to wrap it up. They must be favourites to win it. England haven't won a Grand Slam in 10 years. It's gone again, so it will be 11 next year. And they haven't won the championship, I think, in 6 years. So we tend to forget the lulls that England go into. Go back to Eddie Jones when they were 18 in a row. Eddie was condemned.
Yep.
What's he doing here? Those who have come and followed haven't quite got the rewards. What they've got is the odd win against Australia or the odd win against a vulnerable New Zealand side. And it's like, wow, they're back. Or that freakish result that England got against France a couple of years ago at Twickenham. Mm. I think it was last season.
Mm.
So when you look at the mix, are you more educated 3 rounds down the line as per pre-tournament? And has anything changed in your view of the 5 teams?
So I think what's interesting about the Six Nations is it's such a short competition compared to a club competition. It's a compact, short competition. And so the teams are coming sort of in cold in the sense that they haven't played. This is their first game of the year. They last played in November. And there's almost like an element of this start of the competition that is teams finding their feet a little bit. And I think the guys that come into the comp able to lean into cohesion and with some momentum are successful early on. But I think to win it, you've got to be like France. You've got to be able to produce that the whole way through, obviously. I wouldn't be surprised if England bounced back and put a big score on Italy, for example. I think they have it in them. I just don't think that it's the England performance we expected in this campaign, where you're like, oh, okay, I can see where these guys are going. They're in control and, you know, they're sort of asserting dominance in key facets of the game.
But don't you think it also, again, shows up the folly of talking about a World Cup that gets played near the end of 2027,
yeah,
in the beginning of 2026. 3 weeks ago, England were going to win the World Cup. Now they don't even know if they're going to finish top three of the Six Nations. And that's how quickly it changes in a fortnight. And I think that's what South Africa's done brilliantly is they've done their talking on the field through consistency, winning 80%+ of the games over the last 18 months. And that's what Rusty keeps on saying. You keep on winning, that's a habit. You keep on going, building the depth of the squad. France are doing the same thing now. But talk of a World Cup. A World Cup gets won at a World Cup. It's a tournament within a calendar season.
Mm.
And I've seen teams go to the World Cup under the cosh and actually get to finals, beat some big teams on their way to it.
Mm.
You think of that England side in 2007, they were nowhere. So they got a bit of momentum and they played South Africa in the final.
Mm.
You think of 2003 Australia, pumped in the build-up, conceded 50 points to New Zealand in Sydney,
mm,
went and beat them,
mm,
got to a final and took England to 100 minutes. France, 2011, they lost the pool games against Tonga. I think they lost two pool games, sneaked through 8-7 in the final against New Zealand. So a World Cup is a very different thing,
mm,
and only one team can win it. You've still got a rugby championship to be played, the New Nations Championship, another Six Nations, and a shortened version of the rugby championship before you get to the World Cup.
Mm.
So to my English mates, I want to say there is hope. You don't have to go from the hysteria of being World Cup champions to being basement dwellers. It's going to be okay. To Ireland, I do think it was a bit of an Indian summer match. It's like this was what we were capable of, and we managed to turn it on. And now the illusion's going to be that Ireland's back, but they're not back.
No. And when you said that, you know, in Indian summer in Ireland, I thought about how their scrum struggled against Italy and then how England failed to dominate the Irish tight five. You've got to wonder, like, Italy's scrum, how good is it? What are England going to do when they come up against that? Because those guys sent Tadhg Furlong airborne, and now they're going to be scrumming England. So that's going to be an interesting battle when those two teams meet up. Yeah, look, Ireland, they've got players that have been close to the summit and have been some of the world's best players that are probably closer towards the end of their career than the start. And they've got some youngsters that I really like, some Irish blokes who I really, really like. For me, Balakoon should have been in the mix ages ago and more used more often. I like Crowley. I think Frawley's a good guy. I think Osborne has got quality. I think O'Brien's good. I mention these guys all the time. Even Craig Casey, as much as he's one of those guys that you love to hate, which is exactly what you want at nine. But again, it just comes down to, can they find that sort of rugged brute, the next Tyke Byrne, that physical, no-nonsense bloke who's on the edge of getting sent off every game. They need more of that in that Irish pack, and I just don't see that yet.
And Josh Neal, second match in a row, Ireland under 20, they beat England.
Yeah.
Play of the match.
Bring him up.
Love that accent every time he gets up, speaks about the pride of the Irish jersey.
Yeah.
You could see him in the senior mix in the, within the next 18 months. Certainly not a long shot to go to the World Cup if he continues that. Gets into the Leinster. He's in the academy. Gets a bit of game time in the URC post the Under-20 Championship. He certainly has made an impression that the hype was justified for him. Mm. SA Under-18.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic player here. Rondebosch, boys high, old boy. Very talented. His brother, as we said, went over 2 years before him, has already played international cricket for Ireland. So a very talented family, and we follow his career path, and it's great to see him doing so well. Six Nations is on a break. What's not on a break is the URC. Yes, baby! It's back in its full glory. There was that delayed match from round eight because the Lions and Sharks had decided they won't play each other over the festive season. They'll rather wait till now. And the big thing, I back the Sharks to win, you back the Lions to win. The big thing there was, spoke to Gavin Rich as well. He said, can the Sharks back it up without the emotion of playing the Stormers? I did back them to win just before I saw the team announcement. I still thought, given the kind of team that he had picked, that they would be good enough to win. But hell, full credit to the Lions. I thought they were dominant. I thought Morne van den Berg was outstanding. And they were comfortable winners. And I concur with JP Peterson. One step forward for the Sharks, two steps back.
Yeah, unfortunately for the Sharks, that is the result they really didn't want because they were building such great momentum on the cusp of clinching the SA Shield in that game with a win. But I think there was, I said it in that preview that we did, I thought there was a lot of sort of off-the-field stuff that was being taken care of leading up to this game that maybe didn't have them as singularly focused on this match like the Lions. The Lions would have been licking their wounds after that loss to the Bulls and eager to bounce back. And I thought they bounced back in a way that was emphatic because they played really smart rugby. They used the altitude to their advantage. Yeah, I just thought it was a really solid all-round performance from them, and maybe a little bit more less conservative in some of the facets and a little bit more aggressive. They started to take a few more chances and try and win some penalties and put some pressure on opposing teams. I think there's good things on the horizon for them.
All right, so you've done a lot of analysis on the Lions. I mean, you had to do it for that first round game where the Stormers won. You've watched them all season. What was significantly, if anything, different from a technical point of view in their performance against the Sharks, to educate the layperson out there, than what you've picked up maybe over the last season and a half in terms of trends?
Yeah, I think the Lions, they do the basics well. We've spoken about it before. They don't maybe have the most expensive squad in the country, but they get the most out of their guys. Everybody there seems to be motivated and really bought into what they're doing. For me, the Stecco try of the week was Morne van den Berg's try, where he puts it over the top. Kellyn Peck, who chases. The Sharks do a bad job of trying to collect that ball. And when Mpeku gets tackled, it's Morne van den Berg who's on his shoulder, takes the ball, try time. And it's that sort of unstructured attacking opportunity that comes from an attacking kick that hits grass that I think makes them particularly dangerous. And then with Club Akanya there, the scrum has a solid foundation. Their line-out has showed signs of improvement. And then, yeah, they're a tricky team to play. You get really, really quick ball against the Lions, and sometimes that can put you in a tricky situation where you're almost playing a little bit faster than you can control. So they've got their own system. They're quite a unique team in the way that they operate, and that makes them dangerous.
And again, 15 has to play 15. 7-6 going into the 30th minute. Sharks looking comfortable. Lions looking okay. It's like this one could go down to the wire. Breakaway. Jaden Hendricks plays the man he shouldn't. He doesn't have to. Cynical, gets the yellow card. Penalty to the corner. Line-out drive, score from the kickoff, basically score again. 7-6 becomes 27, and they never came back from that. And then when they went down to 14, the Lions, just before halftime, accidental head clash again, they scored first. And that was it. That was game over for me. Jorenzo Julius, the boogeyman, got a well-deserved try at the end after the hooter, 34-22. For me, he was the one bright spot, playing him at 12. He carried well. He was confident. He broke the tackle. He looked like a test-type player in a losing cause where there weren't too many on both sides. I'd say Morne van der Berg certainly showed why he's in the Springbok equation.
Definitely.
And showed a maturity to his game. But when you looked at the rest, you didn't look and think, there's 10 Springboks on this park today.
No.
You looked and you felt there's a 12 who could potentially be a Springbok, and there's definitely a 9 who's played for the Springboks.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of how I summed it up.
Yeah, yeah. So we spoke about France and how the backs looked amazing because the tight five is so powerful and dominant. The Sharks had the opposite of that. So there was a squad rotation. There was some changes made to that pack. And you could see it wasn't the frontline guys that were repping there for the Sharks. And the Lions made the most of it, took full advantage. 100% boogeyman, I thought, was great. I thought that the Sharks had gone away a little bit from what worked for them against the Stormers, with Jordan Hendrickson at 10 doing a chunk of the kicking and his brother doing the other bit. These Sharks leaned heavily into Fussy's boot, and it changed the way the flow of that game a little bit, and I think the Lions did a great job of pouncing on that.
Yeah, and Fussy, who's been very good all season, it's just one of those games where you overkicked, potentially took the wrong option. His kicking game wasn't 100%. And then Siamazuku, good goal kicker, but he does play very deep in the pocket, which made Julius's impact even that much more impressive for
totally.
Me. It's not like he was playing outside of Henry Honeyball, who basically takes
on the gain line.
He takes it on the gain line. Yeah, he could be number 8. And I really, really was impressed with the way he played. What do you make of the Lions midfield?
Look, I think Bronson Mills is a guy and another player on the rise. You know, he's reckless and raw. I said he reminds me a little bit of Gavin Henson in the early days, where you can see there's a prodigious talent there, but you kind of got to funnel it and put it in the right direction. I thought he was very, very good. And obviously, Henkhoff and Vake is a guy that brings a lot of power to the contact situation. They're two guys with a proper character. Like, they're not just two oaks you're going to run over. I think that really does give the Lions defense some teeth.
And what I also enjoyed about their win is they chase everything. And Angelo Davids, I mean, former Stormer, province man, educated at Stellenberg High, has gone up to the Lions and he's really looked a lot better up there. His conditioning has improved. He's got that kind of hunger that we saw when he was playing for the South African Sevens. And your kickers even turn a bad kick into a good one. Your chasers turn a bad kick into a good one.
Yeah.
And I thought Morne van der Berg recognized that with his kicking game, and Chris Smith. I think Chris Smith has been such an important addition to the development of Morne van der Berg's game, because he is a general who's been around. He's played everywhere. He was very good for the Bulls. He went to France. He's come back. He's an authority in terms of fly-half play. A yard too slow to ever play test rugby, a good goal kicker. But I think he's given Morne so much more confidence to back his own game and not just be this link, but to also control aspects of the game, especially that little short kick over the top, which is the Anton Dupont speciality. But it works wonders. It really puts a winger or a fullback into two minds. We saw Fussy tried that fly kick. We saw another one that bounced. No one seems to go for it. So, yeah, I just thought for Kruppies it was a lacquer game.
It was a great game for him.
And an important game for him to also remind people the conversation isn't just about Graham Williams and Kubus Reiner. He's in the mix. It's important for him to also play up against another Bok in Jaden Hendrickson. There's talk of Fuff potentially coming back to South Africa. Jan Piet is in the mix as well. So there's 6 good scrum-offs that form the basis of the national setup.
At the moment. We've got tons of scrum-offs. No problem there at all. Absolutely unending stream of those guys from juniors all the way up. And yeah, Kruppie deserves to be right near the top of that list because he's a fabulous player. And his combination with Chris Smith and then the left boot of Kuen Horn is what gives the Lions their edge and allows them to play the way that they play. So very, very good player and a tricky customer to take care of.
Okay, so Lions, you guys are traveling this weekend to play them in Johannesburg. Never an easy side to beat. They're 3 from 5 in the SA Shield. The SA Shield, the only matches that count for those who don't know, because I didn't know until the start of the season as well, is the Shield is not which South African team finishes the highest in the URC. It's only on those local derbies. As Al said, the Sharks, they could have wrapped it up. They would have been 4 from 5. They're now 3 from 5. The Lions are 3 from 5. The Bulls are 1 from 4, and the Stormers are 2 from 4. Realistically, every single one of those teams can win the South African Shield, even the Bulls. If results go their way and they get 2 bonus point wins, they could get to 17 points and take it.
Yeah.
So much to play for as well. This weekend, which is the doubleheader, it's the Stormers in Johannesburg at Ellis Park against the Lions, and it's the Sharks who go to Loftus to play the Bulls, who sent probably about 70% of their match day squad down to Wellington. They played against Borland, and they won 31-24, so they got a good hit out in that game. Talk to me about the Sharks now. Those six or seven Springboks that were arrested will come back against the Bulls.
You think so?
How much pressure now on them to go get a result in Pretoria?
No, I don't think the Sharks are in a position where they can say, you know, I think there's a lot of hype around the Sharks since they beat the Stormers twice in a row, but I don't think they're a team that can have any expectation. They're a team that's still in recovery mode. Have they built momentum in recent weeks? Absolutely. Have they shown signs of life and the potential to break back into serious contender mode? For sure. But I don't think that this... It's not like they'd won 12 in a row and now they had a little hiccup and now they've got to go prove themselves again. I think for the Sharks, they're proving themselves week to week. I think the lesson from the last week is don't try and sprint before you can crawl. Do the basics first. Because if you take your eye off the ball for a second, even against the Lions, who are perennial underachievers, I suppose you could say, they will punish you, you know, on the high fault. So the Sharks need to go back to the fundamentals. They've got the power of those Springboks that you mentioned. When those stalwarts come back, they'll have more momentum physically on the field and in the collision. And then I think a lot of their plan will start to click back into place. But the lesson there is you just got to keep playing the numbers a little bit more.
And the Bulls, I mean, they've been on a roll pre the break. This is one they have to win, eh?
Mm. I would feel like the Bulls are under more pressure. They're at home. The expectation is you win on the high faults. And they've underperformed this season despite a star-studded roster. You'd think that they'd want to click back in because they've kind of had a lot of grace to get back to this space and a lot of time to prepare for this game. You'd think the pressure would be on them.
So we call this the Curry Cup within the URC always. The essence of strength against strength.
Yep.
South Africa's best four clubs, franchises, whatever you want to call them. They're certainly not provinces anymore. But the Sharks, for example, they had one win from six against international opposition. And going into Saturday's game, they were three from four against South African opposition, going for the SA Shield. The Lions, with that win, broke into the top eight to go seventh. The Bulls are in eighth at the moment, but also three from five.
Yep.
So you've got the potential even of this ending a three from six for every team. What does that tell you about, one, the derby element, or basically how evenly split our squads are in terms of strength?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I also think you have to look at the schedule and who travels early and who travels late. And there's just a lot of moving parts now with so many competitions and so much movement around the globe. It's not just the country. And everybody's got a different strategy for how they're going to resource all of those demands. So it's possible to catch teams cold early at home, you know, at your home, and then when you get to them at the end of the season at their home, it's a completely different spectacle, you know. So it is interesting. It definitely shows, like you say, the SA Shield is wide open, and that's great for South African rugby, that everybody is competitive. You know, you look at the table, the Lions are seventh, the Bulls are eighth, and you've got the Sharks in 10th and the Stormers at 3rd. So that's a very congested middle of the table. We've got a couple of those teams with games in hand on other sides. So the South African teams are in a position to move up the standings quickly, and these local derbies that count to the SA Shield will count dramatically towards that.
But if you also look at it, Six Nations takes a break, but none of those players will play in the URC this weekend from the core.
Correct.
You may get a fringe player who they want to give a bit of game time.
Yeah.
So that also skews a potential result where one of the favourites may drop a game because they minus all the international players.
Totally.
So it just it is jeopardy.
Totally. So the teams that don't have a lot of internationals, this is the heyday for them because they're pretty much playing their full strength sides with cohesion against the B team of some of the favourites in their shield, I suppose.
Okay, but now you're in the management structure at the Stormers. So whether you were the Stormers, Sharks, Bulls, or Lions, I'll be asking the same question. You've been on the outside, observing, commentating, writing, talking about a competition like the URC. Now you experience it firsthand inside the camp. How difficult is it when you go basically full on to get to 10 matches? Then you have to break for 3 weeks. Then you go back and you play one game. Then you break for another week or 2 weeks. Then you go back and play another two games, and then you're in another competition. You're effectively playing one game in six, and then you've got to back up three games in 3 weekends in two different competitions. From a coaching perspective, from a player perspective, it must be one huge challenge.
Yeah, look, I from my perspective, I feel like having 10 games in a row, that's the hard part, because physically that is massively demanding on the players. And when you have an injury or a hiccup or there's a logistical issue, there is just no time to resolve it. You have to patch it up and continue to play. And so I think that's where the challenge comes for the coaching. For the fan, from a media point of view, the week break and the sort of cessation of hostilities doesn't help for the fan, but certainly for the players and for the coaches, that is a much needed opportunity to just take, you know, reload, restock. A guy who's got an injury, he's got another week to recover. There's opportunities for a bit of a stock take in terms of your thinking around how you're playing or what the opposition, the next game really presents in terms of challenges and opportunities. So I think the breaks are very welcome for the players. It's a hell of a long, arduous season. But it does add a wrinkle into it, because it almost, you know, you don't get into that routine because there's so much change. You've got a long spell of games, you're overseas, you're back home, and then you've got this week off, 2 weeks off, on, 3 weeks off, on. So it does break the monotony of it. And I think there's a mental refresher in there for the players and the coaches.
All right, so there is URC going on at the moment. It's a full-on weekend. Go to SA Rugby Magazine, our WhatsApp channels for the fixtures, the kickoff times, etc. There is rugby being played in Japan. Lots of South Africans there. Every time I look up, Jesse Krill's doing a coin toss. I mean, they love him over there. He really has been one of the players they've taken to. We know Curtly Orange is going back there. There's lots of South Africans playing there. The good news is all the primary ones that are playing for the Springboks are playing well, and they're doing the business. Quacha Smith's getting rave reviews. Dukes always gets rave reviews. So it's a good news story from Japan for the Springboks. In Super Rugby Pacific, they enter round two. The Crusaders are 0-2. First time in 26 years that they've lost at home to the Brumbies. They conceded 3 tries in the last 10 minutes. Have you ever known a Crusader side to do that? Okay, 3 tries in the last 10 minutes. The match was in the balance. James Stipper played his 200th game and scored a try. I mean, what a great occasion. Stephen Larkham played in the Brumbies team that won 26 years ago. He's now coached this team. And he was quite upfront to say afterwards, listen, yeah, they could have won it with 10 minutes to go. It was like quite a blowout. And then he said, caution to the wind. They also conceded 50 against the Chiefs in round two last season and went on to win it. But this is a 30-year celebration in Super Rugby Pacific. Yep. The only thing not there is our South African teams. And they're all playing in their original kit.
Love it.
And in 1996, the Crusaders ended 12th. Okay. The Blues were the top team then. You know, those incredible, like the Zinzan Brook and Sean Fitzpatrick Blues. Yeah. They won it back-to-back. It was only in their third year when the Crusaders won it at Eden Park. And it was James Kerr. I mean, James Kerr, who was a Blues player, who had put on loan to the Crusaders, scored in the 80th minute. Yeah. So, and then obviously the Crusaders dominate from there on in. Did you see any of Super Rugby? Max Jorgensen scored a great try again. Yes. He's not a bad player.
I saw that. No, he's done very well, mate, with his opportunities. Very, very well. I didn't expect that from him. I thought, this is a bloke who's sort of riding the coattails of his name, but he really has turned into a very dangerous little player and pops up in the right places at the right time. I had a side eye on the Super Rugby stuff. What I did see in watching some of the games was you know, I've been saying, like, who does the next All Blacks coach, who does he pick? Like, where's this next tier of player? Ruben Love is the guy that they talk about, but he's unavailable now and he never gets an opportunity. But in watching some of that Super Rugby, as much as I don't think that these guys are necessarily the world's best players, there are players in those franchises that do need to get picked now. The All Blacks do need to actually move on from this current generation and start playing guys and give them an opportunity to step up and prove that they can swim at the next level. Because I just feel like it's almost become a bit stale there. Like the fact that the loss of Dalton Papali'i is such a big thing for those guys. They need to unearth the next generation of loose forwards and move on. If you went back in time, I don't think Dalton would feature anywhere on a depth chart, even at his best, with the likes of Richie McCaw, Jerome Kaino, the list is long. Kieran Reid, Marty Holler, even back in the day. You know, like, you just think back to those guys. They're a talented rugby nation, and maybe they've just invested too long in this current crop of players. Maybe it is time to start rolling the dice a bit and giving some other guys a go.
Well, I think that's where, if you look at Dave Rennie being the front runner with Jamie Joseph, New Zealand doesn't seem to know where to turn to. But to me, either one is a good option. My personal favorite would be Dave Rennie. I think he would be the right guy culturally for New Zealand, and also when it comes to how do you beat a team like South Africa or a team like England and France. I mean, he's had success against all those teams when he was the Wallabies coach. And he would be working with naturally more talented rugby players. And then Jamie Joseph, obviously what he did with Tony Brown in Japan, and he's been back in the mix with the Highlanders. And then also All Black, played in the 95 World Cup, took that All Black 15 on tour. Three wins from three. They beat that Barbarian side that was loaded with South African players. 19-0 down, came back and won 30-19. And also players that you look and think, none of them featured in Scott Robertson's banter. But they can't be that bad if they're knocking over some of the players, player composition teams we saw. So I agree with you that you look at the individuals there and you think, why aren't they being played? Where's that freshness coming from? And that could have been, it's like the Haney Kamea Bulls thing, the Scott Robertson Crusaders thing. The overthrow of a coach who was so long in the system that he just refused to see outside a certain parameter.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't the fact that like Scott Robertson was appointed, you know, years after he should have been appointed. Maybe it was the fact that he inherited players that should have kind of been moved on or at least challenged for their positions seasons ago. Where they just seem to be sort of recycling the same guys who are consistently in the teams that are underperforming.
Yeah, so if you take the Rassie example and the Gaultier example. So Rassie picks Sasha for six tests. He's got a double World Cup winner, standing around Andre Pollard on the bench, and he's got a very experienced player, Marnie Lebok, who's sitting in the stands, or vice versa. Now you've got a Damien Penno that you can send away. A Gael Fiku is on 98 tests. He hasn't picked at all in the Six Nations, but he will still pick them. You never saw that with New Zealand.
No.
They went from Damien McKenzie to Beauden Barrett. Damien McKenzie, Beauden Barrett. Will Jordan at fullback, Damien McKenzie at fullback. It's like they were just, the deck chairs were being shuffled the whole time. We heard about Ruben Love. We heard about the big bustling midfielder from the Highlanders. We heard about players in the Chiefs back division. We heard about certain loose forwards with the Blues. But they just never got picked.
No, 100%.
So I do believe they do have cattle there. And you see the old ex-players coming in, the Sean Fitzpatricks, the Rich McCaws. They no doubt that the players are there. It's like which coach will be able to come in and find them, put together a combination that speaks to the DNA of the All Blacks. And the DNA of the All Blacks has never just been side to side, coast to coast. It's been great defense, a mongrel pack, and then backs who can turn it on from the counterattack.
Totally. And I mean, like Bodie is a fantastic playmaker. Maybe he doesn't have the refined skill set in the kicking game that you want necessarily at 10, but I mean, he makes his defense sit up and take notice because he's such a line break threat, huge speed, bigger than you think in contact. So where do you play him? You had Richie Mwanga. Is he the 10? Is he not the 10? Is he the fullback? Is he not the fullback? And just when you're trying to get your head around that, his brother's in the mix at fullback and then at 12. And that, we've spoken about it, changes how the All Blacks can play and the punch that they get from midfield. And then his brother, is he a 7? Is he a 4? Is he a 7? Is he a 4? He's in the 4 and he's in a massive leadership role. All three of those guys are in the All Black setup. But you could have a debate around where you should play all three of those blokes. Isn't that sort of like back in the day, it was, I wouldn't say specialist, but you kind of knew exactly who was who and where they played. Manonu debuted on the wing, but it wasn't long before he was in the center and then he did massive damage in the midfield. Conrad Smith was a fixture at 13 for many, many years. Will Jordan is arguably the best finishing fullback in the world, but he keeps getting shifted around to accommodate the circus. Like, you just feel like somewhere somebody's got to put their hats on a player in a position, and then you've got to run with that to the end of that experiment and potentially field guys who are lesser players around them. The Brumbies had that issue sort of after their heyday where they had Gitto, Beal. Oh, not Beal. It was Gitto. It was actually the Wallabies when they had Gitto, Beal. They had all of these playmakers that they could slot into a team. Matty Rogers was around at the same time. All these electric playmakers in space. But you were just like, okay, so where are we actually going to start this guy? What position does he play and how do we fit into that? And you kind of just get soup out of that. You don't actually get a solid meal out of it. You just get a bit of grey matter. And I think that's where the All Blacks are right now.
And we are interested in this country. It's the greatest rivalry tour. Three test matches in South Africa, the fourth one in the United States. And they play all four our URC franchises, which would be like that All Blacks 15 that went on tour. It'd be their kind of reserve depth. We don't know if it's going to be Rennie or if it's going to be Jamie Joyce. It'll be one of the two. So do keep on watching the news for the All Blacks. I'm going to start watching Super Rugby primarily with an eye on the New Zealand teams because we don't play Australia this year. We'll worry about Australia next year when we play them in the Rugby Championship, and we also play them at the World Cup. But, Zelzy, this is going to be a tough week for you. You guys are prepping for the Lions. Oof. They're a bloody dangerous team for the
Very
Stormers.
Dangerous.
Why are they such a dangerous team, mate?
Mate, because they can take you out of your game. You take the bait, and they can punish you. Once they get you playing their game, you can get in trouble fast. So, and I think they're underrated in some of the key parts of the game. They are a very, very dangerous team. And they always play with a point to prove, every single one of those guys.
Are they, player for player, a far better quality team than most give them credit for?
Definitely.
And why don't people give them any credit?
I suppose
including myself. Yeah. Why?
Well, I suppose in many cases it's guys that weren't the golden boys coming out of school, right? They're the guys that kind of were in the queue for greatness but were never really featured. Like a guy like Chris Smith has been around. He's had to go overseas. He's come back. People see his value. Obviously, he went to Sachs. Must mention that. People see his value, but he's never really been the featured guy in a team that had a good chance of success. He's always sort of wrong place, wrong time. I think the Lions is full of players that were wrong place, wrong time, right? You get some guys that may be overachieving their careers because they're just at the right team at the right moment. For a lot of these Lions players, it's been the reverse. And now they've kind of got to prove to people, hang on a minute, you overlooked us. They're the Tom Brady's of rugby, right? Taken in the sixth round. With a bunch of guys taken ahead of them that they believe they are better than. And I think that really does give them a chip on their shoulder and makes them a very, very dangerous side.
Okay, bud. Good luck for the rest of the week. We'll chat again on Thursday where we know the match 23s. I won't ask you for the Stormers one. I'll wait for the official announcement on Thursday.
Villain Duval's back.
I know he's back with Derek Okon. Definitely going to be a kicking game that. 1-15, 1-10. Good luck, though, with the training. I know it's... It's your two favorite teams. It's the one you work for and the province you play in and one you've always really liked because you love the underdog.
Yeah.
And then the big other one, South African one, obviously Pretoria, Akers' Bulls up against JP's Sharks. So it's good. And there's a whole full round of URC. So stay tuned. Go to SA Rugby Magazine and put your details in there, guys, gals, and whoever else you are. And you could potentially win 100,000 Rand. It's a great prize. If you put your details in and you sign up, we'll announce that prize end of June, just before the July Internationals, the Nations Championship, just before we play England on the 4th of July at Loftus and whip them. And then obviously the greatest rivalry tour, All Blacks against the Springboks. That first test is going to be at Ellis Park, our traditional home, the Cathedral. Second one in Cape Town, the DHL Stadium. Third one at the FNB Stadium, 94,000. And then we go to the United States for a fourth one. A money spinner. Well, let's hope the series is tied up by then. And we've won it 3-0. And then obviously that tour starts in Cape Town against the Stormers. So it should be a great occasion. But follow us up on the WhatsApp channel. Follow Zelzy. If you check these arms out, you'll see he's not just crunching in the numbers and the data at the high performance setting. He's also pumping the guns, man. Those guns are looking good. They're looking hot. You should have seen him pre we started recording. They were looking sensational.
Mate, who's this for? What are you doing?
For every wife and girlfriend out there who I get told only watches us because they watch your guns, mate. I bumped into a guy at Deer Park last week, yeah. And he said, "Hey, I love you guys. I love your rugby show. Are you Kier or Zell?"
I've had that plenty of times.
Oh, no, I'm just Kells.
Exactly.
But thanks for loving us. Deal was with it. You said, "It's not like you look alike." Yeah, keep on pumping the guns, brilliant, brother. And yeah, good luck. We will chat on Thursday. We will chat via Zoom because ours will be on the road. So please don't give us any stick about that. We'll be back in studio on Monday.